From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. One of President Obama's signature foreign policy achievements was helping the Southeast Asian nation of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, move towards democracy. After decades of military rule, the country held elections in 2015 that gave a sweeping victory to the opposition National League for Democracy. That's the party of the Nobel Prize-winning activist Aung San Suu Kyi, who is now Myanmar's de facto leader in an uneasy power-sharing arrangement with the military. But now both Myanmar's progress and Aung San Suu Kyi's international reputation are unraveling as Myanmar's security forces are carrying out a massive offensive against the country's Rohingya Muslim minority in its southern Rakhine state. One top UN official has called the offensive, quote, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. More than a half million Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh amid reports that the military has burned more than 200 villages and carried out mass killing and rape of civilians. Now, in a few minutes, we're going to hear more about the recent violence from a panel of guests who have reported extensively on the country. But first, we're going to hear more about Myanmar's long history of discrimination against the Rohingya from Dr. Hla Kya. He's a Rohingya originally from Rakhine State who now lives in the Netherlands and is chairman of the European Rohingya Council. He joins us today from the town of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, right on the border with Myanmar. Hua, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you would, what do we know about what's happening right now inside Rakhine State, just across the border from where you are?
This is clearly a genocide against Rohingya people. Before we call it slow burning genocide, but now it becomes full-fledged genocide. And also, United Nations has already said it is a textbook example of ethnic cleansing and also crimes against humanity. Well, this is what we. Yeah.
Well, what do you see right now where you are in Cox's Bazar? I understand that hundreds of thousands of refugees have crossed the border. Tell us about conditions there.
Yes, last 2 days I have been visiting camps and also setting up some emergency medical care to Rohingya, our Rohingya brothers and sisters. What I saw in the camp is really unspeakable. It is horrible. Most of the children and women are suffering. Almost everybody is suffering from pneumonia, from fever, diarrhea. So it is very, they are not getting medical care. Some of them are getting food, and so charity organizations are providing food, but there are lack of medical care to the Rohingya populations. I see signs and symptoms of infection outbreaks inside the camps because of severe unhygienic condition and also lacking of toilets and overcrowded. Yesterday, I went to a tent where 16 family members are staying there, and 4 days old baby was suffering high fever. So this is the situation there. This is only this one case. There are hundreds and thousands of such cases. Suffering babies are suffering from diarrhea, suffering from fever, suffering from cough. So I see there, if there is no emergency intervention regarding emergency medical care provision, I am really worried about any infection outbreaks.
Well, La Jiao, we should say that you are a physician. You're originally from Myanmar, and it sounds like conditions in these refugee camps are quite desperate. But I wanted to ask you about discrimination against Rohingyas inside Myanmar. This is not something that's new. We understand that Rohingyas don't have citizenship in Myanmar. For years, the government has enforced a two-child policy limiting how many children a Rohingya woman could have. Rohingya need permission from the government to marry. The military has used Rohingya for forced labor. They've been denied access to schools and health care. Your story is a little bit different. Tell us just a bit about your own life and what sorts of difficulties you faced, because it is unusual that you grew up to become a physician.
Actually, I was born in southern part of Mongdo in 1982. Mongdo is a town in Rakhine State. Well, Mongdo is a town which is border to Bangladesh, where genocidal campaign against Rohingya people has been going on until today. When I was born, my parents gave me a Rohingya name, which is Muhammad Khubaib.
But when you went to school, you actually adopted a Burmese name. Why was that?
I adopted a Burmese name because when you have a Rohingya name, you would not get enough grade at exam. Because my parents and me, I wanted to be a doctor, a physician to serve my people, to give medical care to my people. And I adopted this Burmese name, La Jo. While I am studying at middle school and high school, we continuously face severe discrimination in terms of movement, in terms of also at the school, at the market. And when I passed my university entrance exam, at that time, Commander-in-Chief was organizing a award-giving ceremony. I was invited because of being a Rohingya. I was not allowed to travel to the capital city of Rakhine State. And after that, I applied for medical school. And then I was chosen by the medical school. I got a letter of admission, but it was very, very difficult to organize all the paperwork. And we needed to have a lot of recommendation letters from the immigration, from the police.
So because you lack formal citizenship, it sounds like you needed special permission to attend medical school. You didn't get to go to some award ceremonies, some other events in your life, because even just to move from one town to another within Myanmar, you need permission from the security forces.
Exactly.
I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Okay, thank you so much.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the plight of the Rohingya people of Myanmar. More than 500,000 have fled the Southeast Asian nation since August amid an offensive by Myanmar's military that one UN official has called a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. If you're interested in more coverage of underreported international and human rights news, visit us at globaljournalist.org. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. To broaden our discussion, we've got three other guests on the line who are following this closely. Joining us is Shafir Rahman. He's a Bangladeshi documentary filmmaker working on a film about Rohingya women who have fled Myanmar. He's also in Cox's Bazar on the Bangladesh-Myanmar border. And in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, is Florence Louis. She's a Southeast Asia correspondent for Al Jazeera, who has covered Myanmar and the Rohingya extensively for that network. And in Ithaca, New York, is Robert Lieberman. He's also a documentary maker whose credits include the 2012 film They Call It Myanmar, Lifting the Curtain. Well, let me start with you, Shafir Rahman. You are at the border of Bangladesh and Myanmar. Tell us just a little bit about the scene there. What are some of the stories that you've been hearing from people who have fled?
Sure. Just today, I was interviewing this young woman, 15-year-old woman from Tulatuli, a village where people are saying that over 1,000 people have died. It will probably be the largest massacre in this current conflict. This woman was put in a ditch, selected from the others, taken to a hut, raped, knocked out, and then the hut set on fire in order to burn the occupants alive. She survived. She's now in Kutupalong, having spent some time in the clinic. And she cried through her entire interview. She has lost everyone, her parents, her siblings. I think one brother is still alive. And it was very, very harrowing to listen to, and her desperate story.
Let me turn this, if I could, to Florence Louis. Talk to us about access to Rakhine State right now for journalists, for aid workers, for diplomats. What challenges are there to just finding out what's happening on the ground?
It has been absolutely challenging. It's not easy at all getting unfettered access to Rakhine State. The government has allowed journalists and diplomats in, but these have been on government-arranged trips where you're followed by minders, where you have to submit a list to the government about the places and the villages you want to visit, and you are followed every step of the way. And we had a producer who went up on one of these government-arranged trips. It was only when she snuck away from the entire group that she could speak to people there without the presence of either a policeman or a security officer. So the government is still not allowing access to independent journalists and filmmakers, but they are saying that they have been allowing people in, but not explaining that these are very tightly controlled and stage-managed trips. Now, as for access to aid workers, we know that aid workers have been able to go back in, but even then, the situation is such that the other ethnic group, the Rakhines, are still very resentful of aid workers. So there have been challenges for aid groups in distributing aid to the Rohingya population in the rest of Rakhine State as well.
And Robert Lieberman, you spent a long time interviewing people inside Myanmar for your films in the past. How do people from Myanmar's Buddhist majority, from the ethnic Rakhine people in the state who are mainly Buddhist, how do they feel about the Rohingya?
That's a very complex question. I can probably speak more about Suu Kyi, who I've interviewed and who's in the headlines, if you're interested in that. I think people know, of course, that, you know, that the country has seven major ethnic groups and 131 different languages. And there are ongoing civil wars. The Karen War was the longest running civil battle on the planet. The Shan are still at war. The Kachin are still at war. And of course, we have these troubles in the Rakhine. Let me speak honestly about all this. I was on CNN just a little while ago, and they were asking me about Aung San Suu Kyi, since I've interviewed her and I've bumped into her a couple of times. And everybody is very upset that she has not spoken out definitively. And the New Yorker just had a big article on her also. And in our film, they call it Myanmar. She makes it very clear. She says, "I'm just a politician." I'm quoting now. You know, I think politicians who think they've gone beyond being politicians are very dangerous. That's where authoritarianism comes in. I'm just an ordinary politician. And I think that really explains certainly her situation. She is in a kind of squeeze. This is not to condone her silence, by the way. What's going on is horrendous. You know, I'm a child of the Holocaust, so, you know, I can relate to this. But the expectation level for Suu Kyi is very high. She is just a politician. She is afraid, apparently, of alienating her Buddhist majority. Also, she is in a kind of risky situation in terms of the military. If she offends the military, and really goes after, should she really go after them, she could end up back in house arrest. She was in house arrest for 15 years. And there's one more little fact. Her father is a general, was a general, General Aung San, who actually managed that before his assassination, unite various factions in Myanmar or Burma and work towards independence from Britain.
And we should clarify that within the current sort of power-sharing arrangement between Myanmar's civilian government and the military, she does not have direct control over the military or over the security forces who are carrying out this offensive. And actually, we have an audio clip of her speaking just a couple weeks ago in an address that she actually gave in English about what's happening. We're going to hear that in just a moment.
We are concerned to hear that numbers of Muslims are fleeing across the border to Bangladesh. We want to find out why this exodus is happening. We would like to talk to those who have fled as well as to those who have stayed. I think it is very little known that the great majority of Muslims in the Rakhine State have not joined the exodus.
And with that, let me turn this to Shafir Rahman then. What is your take on Aung San Suu Kyi's role in what is happening now in Myanmar?
Sure. I think it's delusional to keep giving Aung San Suu Kyi the benefit of the doubt. I think she has shown none of the attributes that people have claimed for her, her democratic ideals and so on. I think people should be realistic. I think Burma needs to be pressured, and I think Burma, Myanmar needs to be pressured politically and economically. What she's pursuing is not good for our country, is not good for the region, it's not good for the planet. And really, I think people are waking up to that reality.
And let me also ask you, Florence Louis, about her role. I think you've also noted in your reporting that there is sort of a counter-narrative about what's happening in Rakhine State that the Myanmar government has been advancing. At one point, I think the government news service had put out information that the Rohingya were burning their own villages. Tell us just a bit about that.
That's right. And that's the narrative. That's the same narrative that the government has been using when there were attacks by the same militant group known that calls itself the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, when they attacked three border posts last year. And this year they launched coordinated attacks on about 30 border posts on August 25th. Now, the government has been saying that the atrocities that are being committed, the whole scale, the large scale burnings of villages, that's been committed by either Rohingya fighters or people who are sympathetic to them. Now, when our producer went on that trip, she saw was a village that was burning. And the people in that village, this was a Muslim Rohingya village, and the people had left the village a couple of days ago, but there were fresh fires that were started. When they were there as well, they saw a group of Rakhine, ethnic Rakhine Buddhist people. But the government is still sticking to its narrative that the villages that are being cleared, the fires that are taking place, these have been started by the Rohingya themselves. Now, the international community does not believe this story. There are many people who say that this just isn't happening, but that is the story that the government is sticking to. Now, I also want to say a little bit more about Suu Kyi's speech that you mentioned, I think that took place on 18th of September. There were certain elements of that that people have criticized. There were certain untruths in that, where she said the Rohingya don't face discrimination, that they are free to go to school and university. That is clearly not true. And she also said that the military campaign in northern Rakhine State had stopped several days ago. But we are still getting reports that there are villages that are still being burnt down. Now, just today, I got a video from a source of a village in northern Rakhine State that has recently been set on fire.
That speech by Aung San Suu Kyi on September 18th. Once again, the speech was given in English, so it was clearly targeted at an international audience. Let's take a listen again to a separate clip of that references something that you, Florence, just referenced.
The government has upgraded 300 schools in Rakhine. The vocational and technical training programs have begun. Muslim students also have access to higher education without any discrimination. Humanitarian aid reached all communities in 95% of the affected areas before the recent attacks on August 25th. We are now starting another round of humanitarian aid endeavor, which we hope will take care of all the peoples in the region.
And Robert Lieberman, you heard what Florence had to say. It seems like there would be some sort of moral imperative, sort of domestic political pressures aside on Aung San Suu Kyi to clearly condemn what is happening. Is that not the case?
Can we pull the camera back a little and take a broader view? I tend to be more of a globalist. First of all, the Rakhine Buddhists are different from the Buddhists that you'll see, for instance, in Yangon or Mandalay. They are also suspicious of Suu Kyi, have always been suspicious of Suu Kyi. And I think the troubles began when the military, there were elections coming up, and you can correct me on this, and the military allowed the Rohingya to vote. And those who had white cards, that is to say, like our green cards here in America, were permitted to vote. And suddenly that created
And so these aren't citizenship cards for the Rohingya, but they are some sort of identity card that some Rohingya have.
That's right.
That gives them.
And so the military was afraid of losing the election and allowed the Rohingya to vote. Of course, this inflamed the Buddhists, and the military withdrew that right. But, the firestorm had started. Pull back a little bit further and look at Southeast Asia. And there's a kind of madness reigning. We just did our film Angkor Awakens, and it includes a long interview with Hun Sen, the dictator there, where everything is being crushed. He's crushed the newspapers, he's closed the Cambodian Daily, 15 radio stations, opposition leaders have been assassinated, etc. Basically, Hun Sen claims he is channeling Trump. Look at the Philippines, where there's mass killings of drug users. This is going on. It's almost seems to me, and I stand corrected if you wish, that the world is going a little crazy, and Donald Trump has something to do with it.
We'll just take a moment. We'll just take a moment here to remind our listeners that this is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the current crisis in Myanmar, where nearly half the country's minority Rohingya population have been forced to flee by the country's military. We're joined by the documentary filmmakers Shafir Rahman and Robert Lieberman, as well as by Florence Louis, a Southeast Asia correspondent for Al Jazeera. If you're interested in more coverage of underreported international and human rights news, visit us at globaljournalist.org. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the video cast of this program on YouTube. And Florence Louis, you are in Malaysia, which is also home to thousands of Rohingya refugees who have fled previous outbreaks of violence there. It does seem like there is something different about what's happening. Now, we have seen Rohingya fleeing Myanmar in years past, in 2015, I believe in 2013, other years as well. What's different about this time?
I think this time what we're seeing is the military, the Myanmar military, responding with a brutality, with a force that we have not seen before. I mean, we're talking about huge numbers of people who have fled in just the last couple of weeks since August 25th. So that's what, about less than 2 months. More than half, or around half the population of the Rohingya population in Rakhine State have fled across the border into Bangladesh. The Myanmar military and really the government's position is this. What they're doing is conducting a legitimate counter-terrorism operation. That's because they've designated the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Group as a terrorist organization. It is the only terrorist organization in Myanmar. Even the other armed ethnic groups that have been in existence for far longer and who are better equipped are not classed as a terrorist organization by the Myanmar government. So I think what the Myanmar government is trying to do is they want to crush this group. And so they've gone in with a brutality that has never been seen before. And in a sense, this feels very different. But it also, I think what they've also done is they have been pushing out a lot of information that really paints, more or less depicts the entire Rohingya community as sympathizers of this group of fighters as well. And
Florence?
That's why, sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. Feel free to jump in.
Could
Robert.
I inject something?
Sure.
The word Rohingya, by the way, is a political construct, and it's sort of a blanket statement. There is no Rohingya per se. What there are people who came from Bangladesh in the 9th century. There are those who came during the British rule, and then there are the more recent immigrants, both legal and illegal. So when people talk about the Rohingya, it isn't a real thing. I'm not sure who came up with this name. Maybe you can educate me on that.
Well, I think, Robert, that's the narrative that the Myanmar government is trying to push. But if you talk to Rohingya people, they say that there is a group. They have their own language. They call themselves Rohingya.
Well,
I guess it depends on, if we're talking about historical perspectives, if we're talking about the existence of this group, I think we have to understand that there isn't just one perspective here.
Well, let me turn this back to you, Shafir Rahman, if I could. What do we know about this group that the Myanmar government has designated as a terror organization? How widespread is support for them among the Rohingya? Are their actions, I understand they attacked some police stations in August, are they sort of, is the response, it seems somewhat disproportionate to the attacks that this group carried out in August?
I mean, firstly, a brief word about Rohingya and the word and whether it's a political construct or not. I think what we should take, the take-home message is that there's an attack on their identity and there's an attack on their livelihood. these people are targets. And I think that's the most important thing. Regarding the militants, I think from what I understand and for the people that I've come across, this is a very nebulous group indeed. They don't have connections to ISIS or to jihadis. I think you need to understand that people are not going to be sitting ducks if people are herded into concentration camps, if people are denied their livelihood, if they're subject to arbitrary detention, if they're subject to all these myriad laws that affect their daily lives, then some people are going to respond. There are rumors that they are a creation of the Burmese government. But really, I would like to say that people don't like being sitting ducks, and people will not be cannon fodder. And at some point, you are going to get someone striking back.
And Florence Louis, we have heard that roughly half of the Rohingya population of Myanmar has fled. Is this effectively sort of fait accompli? Are the Rohingya effectively being moved out of Myanmar permanently?
It would appear to be so. But also, I just want to remind people who are listening that this isn't the first time that the Rohingya have been fleeing in huge numbers. There have been waves of these of Rohingya population crossing over into Bangladesh since the 70s. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think since the 70s, when Myanmar or Burma, as it was known then, was still under military rule. So this is a group of people who've been facing persecution for decades already.
And Robert, if you could jump in here, yeah. Is there any reason for optimism here? Our time does grow short, but is there reason to hope that there will be some sort of peaceful accommodation?
Well, they've driven out half the population already. Sure, there'll be peace when they've driven everybody out. By the way, under Nguyen, the military dictator before Tan Shui, they drove out the Indians. I don't know if people are aware of this.
Yes.
So there's a history of this. Look, I'm a child of the Holocaust, and I know that if I were packed into a concentration camp, I would definitely fight back. The failure of Suu Kyi to speak out, of course, simply let this thing escalate to the point now where the Rohingya, or whoever you want to call them, are going to fight back. And this is unfortunate. This is the way things happen in the world, just this escalation. It could have been nipped in the bud. Is there a peaceful solution? I don't know.
I'm afraid that we're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Zhao, Shafir Rahman, Robert Lieberman, and Florence Louis for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Maria Calleon, Denitsa Chikova, Yan Chi Tzu, and Anne-Marie Welser. Rachel Foster Gimbel is supervising producer, and our audio engineer this week is Nathan Lawrence. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.